This is East End Inc. Tonight we present public radio commentator David Bouchier reading from his Not Quite the Stranger, Essays on Life in France, and a non-memoir, Lucky Man, A Life in Essays. Here's David Bouchier, recorded in May 2016 at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor.
But the charm of the personal essay is two things, really. One is you don't have to make stuff up, which you do if you're writing fiction. And the second thing is that it's essentially all about that most fascinating of topics, namely yourself. And you can unapologetically write about yourself and seem not to. Seem to be doing something a little bit more intelligent than that. You know, you can be a little bit to the side of it. And that's a valuable quality of the personal essay. You know, as Oscar Wilde said, to love oneself is the beginning of a lifelong romance. And how true it is, you know, that is the subject. And a lot of people who are pretending to write other things are in fact writing all the time about themselves, which is what I do. This book about France first. My family, according to the family legend, came from France, or my father's family, I should say, in 1804, which was the year that Napoleon declared himself emperor. So it was a very good year to move out. And they came to England, and they again apparently were a bunch of people in the entertainment industry, or more precisely, they were circus people. Not to put too fine a point, a bunch of clowns, it seems. And that was the sort of family I grew up with. I can really believe this legend. I hope it's true. But they never had any luck in England with their activities, their theatrical activities. So they had to turn to agriculture and this and that. And by the time I was produced into the world, they pretty much got rid of the French connection completely, literally, psychologically, and in every way. France was another country. It's rather like the people who came to America three or four generations back, and they just wanted to become American. And my family, rightly or wrongly, wanted to become English, and they did. And France was one of those places under the general heading of foreign, which was totally disapproved of. Nasty food, incomprehensible language, goodness knows what, disgusting personal moral habits. You know, it was all of those things that they wanted to get out of their lives. So, of course, for me, nothing was more fascinating than the idea of France. And I didn't have a chance really to go there until I was 1955, I think it was, when I got a motorcycle and therefore the gift of mobility. And went over to France to take a look at it. I think I was 16, just about, and had a wonderful, wonderful time, even though it rained perpetually. I have a memory which I use in this book, first memory of France, which was riding down through the north of France in the pouring rain on my motorcycle and stopping in the city, the cathedral town of Reims, which nobody can pronounce, and looking for a place to eat in the total absence of any French language, and finding a little back street place with a brown painted facade and net curtains, and tottering in there dripping wet, and Madame took me in hand and sat me down and gave me the meal of the day, since there was no menu. And the meal of the day was leek and potato soup and cassoulet. And ever since then, I've associated France with those two things, particularly leek and potato soup for some reason. Whenever I think about escaping, getting away, I think of leek and potato soup first, and then I think of France. So that was the beginning of a long connection. And as Benjamin Franklin said, every man has two countries, his own and France, which is rather nice, suggesting that we've all got this fantasy place that we want to be in, or that we think will be somehow perfect for us. Thomas Jefferson too, for that matter. And in some ways, France is almost an American colony. Although it could have been the other way around, when you think that up to 1803, about half of American territory was French. think what a different country that would have been. So there's a tremendous connection, a very, very strong connection between America and France. In some ways, it's stronger than the connection between England and France, because they're ancient, ancient enemies. And about close to 2 million Americans go to France every day, vast majority of them going to Paris. And this is a place where I've lived from time to time, and this little book has about 10 essays on Paris, but the majority of them about the countryside and about the villages, because it's the villages that I really love, and it's the village life that's the real French life, in my opinion, and it's the real France. Paris is not France any more than New York is the United States. You know, it's what happens out there in the small towns and villages. I want to read you at least one essay about Paris, and then a couple about the village. This one is called the Canal Saint-Martin, and it's just about a locality in Paris in the 10th arrondissement. It was recently the place where that terrible terrorist attack took place, but where we stayed for quite a long time. It's a particular corner of that part of Paris. The Canal Saint-Martin runs right through the middle. It's amazing how quickly we can take possession of a place. A hotel room, a neighbourhood, a village, or even a city is likely to be labelled ours after we've been living in it for a few weeks or even a few days. I suspect this is the human instinct to claim and defend territory that's caused most of the trouble in the world for the past few thousand years. But biology is destiny, and we were happy to return to our neighbourhood in Paris after spending a few days in England. It was reassuring to see the rather scruffy streets and shops just as we'd left them, the elegant old buildings being slowly restored as the area moves up market, and the centrepiece of it all, the Canal Saint-Martin, that gives its name to the neighbourhood, or the quartier, as the French like to call it in their Gallic way. For me, the Canal Saint-Martin was one of the pleasures of living in the 10th arrondissement. I loved the fact that in the crowded heart of the city, the canal opened everything up. One minute you were in the narrow, dark streets, and next you were beside the canal with its great sweep of water and sky. Like a park, it was an antidote to city claustrophobia. So this was where we took our daily walk or bike ride under the plane trees, stopping by the locks at the idlers we were, to watch the barges making their slow way through. And perhaps if we felt more than usually self-indulgent, stopping at one of the many cafes too. It had become our canal. Before it was ours, the Canal Saint-Martin belonged to Napoleon, who ordered it built in 1802 to speed the movement of goods through the middle of Paris. It's an impressive piece of 19th century engineering, with 9 locks, each one an entertainment in itself, that dropped the water level a total of 74 feet in just under 3 miles. For many decades, this was a gritty working-class area, terra incognita for tourists. But about 20 years ago, it began to change, and now it's something of a magnet for the so-called bobos, or bourgeois bohemians. There's even a cafe Bobo, as well as galleries, art centres, an increasing number of boutique stores selling very strange clothes at ridiculous prices. The area has been written up in the New York Times travel section, which is the ultimate guarantee of its trendiness. The old quartier is still there, under the shiny surface of the new shops. There's even a kind of romanticism about the bad old days, captured in a book of beautiful black and white photographs showing the era when tramps or clochards were harnessed like animals to haul the barges, and the canal was nothing but a rough and tough commercial highway with no charm whatsoever. Songs have been written about it, and a lot of local people resent the bourgeois invasion that is transforming their old quartier. The most famous building along the canal is the Hotel du Nord, not because it's a thing of beauty, but because it featured in a romantic film of the same name in 1938. Tourists come to look at the facade of the Hotel du Nord and perhaps have a drink in the bar and marvel at the picturesque street life. Then they head back to the more familiar territory of the Louvre and the Eiffel Tower. But we stayed right there in the 10th arrondissement beside the Canal Saint-Martin. After all, it was our neighborhood. Personally, as I said, I love villages. And so most of my travels in France have been a process of really searching for an ideal place with some fantastical idea of living there, retiring there. And a few years ago, we lived in a village called Anian near to Montpellier, which was an interesting experience. We were there for a little over a year. And Anian was really a very, should we say, a basic village. There was nothing very charming about it. It had had character, but no charm, let's put it that way. And it was a village dedicated mostly to wine and politics, vigorously divided into right-wing and left-wing politics, which took us quite a while to figure out. And that was certainly an experience, but it wasn't the sort of experience you wanted to repeat all that often. This village was actually constructed or founded, so they say, in the year 777, and hadn't really been much improved since. And so it was very narrow, very dark. You couldn't step out the door without encountering your neighbours, who would speak to you in the incomprehensible patois of the south of France, which is a kind of Latinate version of French, which I don't understand because I failed Latin at school, so I've never been able to get a grip of it. So it was a bit of a hard time there. But later on, we were wandering around in an area somewhat closer to the border of Provence, around Avignon and around Nîmes. And we came upon a little village which is called Saint-Quentin-la-Potterie, although if you say it in English, it looks more like Saint-Quentin-the-Pottery, which is a pottery village that's been around for about 400 years, so it's relatively new, new construction really, and which was much more open and charming and actually full of artists and ceramic artists and various kinds of creative people from all over Europe. So this seemed like a much more welcoming place. And by a lucky chance, we actually found a house there that was for sale very, very cheaply. Of course, we found out later why it was cheap. Old house. And we moved into that about 8 years ago. I'll read you a little bit about this old house. When in France we inhabit a small village house, the word inhabit is appropriate because these old stone houses have something of the feeling of cave dwellings, even if they are equipped with modern conveniences on the inside. The village has been here for more than 400 years. The first written mention of it by name occurs in 1552, by which time it was already well established. The basic layout of the streets has not changed much from a map made in the 1600s, and the nearby town of Uzès has been home to the Dukes of France for over 1,000 years. So naturally we were interested in the history of this place, who lived here, and what their lives were like. But it was hard to get any reliable information. Village houses were built for peasants and artisans, and they don't appear in any written record. They've been built on, built over, and renovated for hundreds of years, so there's no overall architectural style, such as might you see in a church or a grand chateau. We have to rely on the clues that we can get from the oldest parts of the building and on the stories told by our neighbours and by the handyman Pascal. These stories are notoriously unreliable. There is something about the history of houses that makes even normally honest people lose their moral bearings. A house, especially an old one, is a subject for romance, so the tales we hear have to be taken with a very large pinch of salt. We can be sure of one thing: the house is seriously old. The popular public television show This Old House claims to be about renovating antique structures, but they're Brooklyn brownstones and Bostonian arts and crafts, a brand new construction compared to our old house. Villagers built these places to last using large chunks of granite, and because they're right in the middle of the village, and because it is right in the middle of the village, the house is supported on both sides by other equally solid and ancient structures. Based on the stone vaulting in the lower part of the house, we guess it was built sometime in the 1700s. Animals were kept down there, and you can still see a stone drinking trough with an iron ring to tether the sheep or goats. Career opportunities were limited. The inhabitants may have worked in the vineyards or in the olive groves and supplemented their incomes with milk, cheese and wool from these animals. Also, from the 19th century, the village had a small industry of pipe making, which led to its present reputation as a centre for ceramic artists. So this old house has seen a lot of history. 8 kings, the French Revolution, 2 emperors, 2 world wars, and 5 republics so far. When it was first built, Louis XIV, the Sun King, was living in splendour in his palace at Versailles, oblivious to the revolution that would sweep his royal descendants away. And in Paris, intellectuals like Voltaire were fomenting the political revolution called the Enlightenment. But out in the country, life in villages like this must have been brutally hard, with hot summers, cold winters, back-breaking work, and not much in the way of entertainment, apart from the occasional religious war. At first, the house seemed semi-sacred just because of all that heavy history. I even hesitated to drill a hole in the wall to hang a picture, but I needn't have worried. The electric drill just bounced right off the granite, and I had to hang the picture somewhere else. These old houses survive for a reason. They don't yield to storms, floods, earthquakes, or temporary occupants with electric drills. They're here for the duration, whatever that duration may be. I said I wouldn't say anything about politics, but I will just read you this one. It's called The Senators Speak. A bench in the marketplace is occupied by a regular assembly of not very old retired men. They're known as the senators because all they do is talk. Apart from playing the occasional game of bowls, that is, and making frequent trips to the bar, which by lucky coincidence is right beside their bench. They passionately discuss the question of early retirement, the strikes and demonstrations in the streets, the deficit, the Middle East, the price of olives, and the relative merits of the local wines. At least I think they're talking about these things, but they have picturesque local accents that make it difficult to be sure. But nobody else discusses the issues of the day so thoroughly and at such great length in any accent. Politicians in Paris or Washington prefer not to discuss them at all. The Greek agora, or marketplace, was the cradle of democracy precisely because citizens gathered there to hear and to argue about the things that matter to them. If the mayor wants to know what is going on in his village, he has only to come down to the marketplace and listen to the senators. That's real democracy, and perhaps democracy only works on the small scale when everybody can join in. Early one morning, I arrived at the market and found the bench of the senators was empty. Feeling very bold, I sat down there for a few minutes, enjoying the sensation of being at the epicentre of village politics, although I could never hope to be elected there. When the Senate is in session, the bench is fully occupied from end to end, so I assume that, as in Washington, an incumbent has to fall off before a vacancy occurs. This is just the kind of modest, down-to-earth Senate we need in Washington. A few talkative senior citizens, a rusty bench, and some cheap red wine would accomplish everything that the present Senate accomplishes at infinitely less cost. Their debates might be incomprehensible, confused, irrelevant, and incoherent, but how would we ever know the difference?
This is EastEnd Inc. on WPKN Radio. We heard public radio commentator David Bouchier reading from Not Quite the Stranger, Essays on Life in France. We continue with Mr. Bouchier reading from Lucky Man, A Life in Essays.
This is about my curious career as a bookseller. It's appropriate for here at Canio's. It's prefaced by a quote from a famous publisher called Stanley Unwin, which is worth reading. He says, "To write books is easy. It requires only pen and ink and the ever-patient paper. To print books is a little more difficult because genius so often rejoices in illegible handwriting. To read books is more difficult still because of a tendency to go to sleep. But the most difficult task of all that a mortal man can embark on is to sell a book. Right. And it's true. A short half century ago, I had the good fortune to become a bookseller. Like most of the interesting things in my life, this happened by accident. A small bookstore in North London, previously operated by the Communist Party, had become vacant, and with no more than the briefest personal experience, I was brave or foolhardy enough to take it over and transform it into something more reader-friendly. The old stock, including the complete works of Karl Marx in German and the complete works of Joseph Stalin in Russian, were shipped out to find a more appreciative audience. And the shelves were filled up with modern novels, classics, children's books, and all the other delightful literary paraphernalia of a small general bookstore. In those days, we didn't sell cards, greeting cards, CDs, magazines, etc., only books. Nothing could have been more delightful. Nothing could have been more pleasing to me than to be king in my own small domain of books. I read the reviews, read the books themselves, ordered them from publishers' representatives according to my whim, produced a little newsletter for customers, some of whom were quite famous writers, and talked about books all day long. It was the most agreeable of occupations. Bookselling is an historic and even romantic profession. I mean, once printing had been invented in the 15th century, the first bookstores soon appeared, often combined with a publishing and printing enterprise. These were mainly small and precarious businesses, so nothing much has changed there. But because of the quirky customers they attracted and the many secrets that might be hidden in the books themselves, bookstores came to feature in many novels. There are Victorian bookshop mysteries, cat bookshop mysteries, haunted bookshop mysteries, tales by Umberto Eco, Sylvia Townsend, Paul Auster, Ross King, Lawrence Block, and one I read a little while ago called Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookshop by Robin Sloan. Lots of fun. Many authors have found the bookstore a convenient setting, an ideal hiding place for criminals, amateur detectives, mystics, and antisocial misfits. If you give one of your characters a job in a bookstore, something strange is bound to happen. Bookselling has come to seem a quaint and antique activity, like thatching or blacksmithing, and has largely been taken over by corporate enterprise selling from the internet. A few independent bookstores still survive, like gorillas in the jungle. Most of them are rather eccentric places that remind me of my own enterprise in London all those years ago. Short-lived because bookselling is not one of the most profitable occupations. Even in the 1960s, only a few people read books, and still fewer bought them. My accounting was always on the optimistic side, and perhaps rather idiosyncratic too. Profit never entered my mind. Must have been the influence of the old communists in that bookstore. In fact, I enjoyed buying books much more than selling them, a fatal weakness, which eventually led me to change tracks and start a new career in education. As a teacher, I was finally free to read all the books I wanted without ever having to sell one. This one is called Life Plan. It's also prefaced with a little quote. I'm addicted to quotes. This is from Ambrose Bierce, The Devil's Dictionary. The future, definition. That period of time in which our affairs prosper, our friends are true, and our happiness is assured. Every year, thousands of proud and impoverished parents watch their children graduate from colleges all over the country. The ceremony is called commencement, perhaps because it signals the beginning of adulthood, financial responsibility, real work, and all the other horrors of grown-up life. It's a scary time for the graduates, comparable to going over the top in the trench warfare of World War I and facing enemy fire for the first time. The parents feel relieved, but the young graduates feel slightly lost. Suddenly they realise that they need a life plan that will guarantee a smooth passage through career and marriage to retirement and the nursing home and the final graduation. My best friend at high school, Michael John Charles Young, had a detailed life plan by the age of 15. He had it all worked out. A degree in economics, a safe government job, a little house, a wife, two children, an early retirement at 60 to a resort on the coast. I've lost touch with him, but I hope he made it. If he did, he's been retired 10 years by now and is almost certainly a grandfather. The traditional role of the commencement speaker is to suggest at least the outlines of a life plan by promoting positive thoughts and values. Unfortunately, nobody knows what these are, so graduates get mixed messages. Some colleges avoid this problem by choosing as speakers characters from Sesame Street or entertainment celebrities who can be relied upon not to say anything serious at all. Indeed, the trouble with most commencement speakers is that they tend to offer dumb and discouraging metaphors. Life is a mountain to climb. Life is a race to be run. Life is a game to be played, a challenge, a pilgrimage. But in reality, life is just a series of things that happen one after another, some of which are amusing and some are not. We know from quantum physics that randomness is at the centre of how the world is put together at the subatomic level. Experience tends to confirm that this randomness goes all the way up, perhaps all the way up to the White House. This is good, because without randomness, life plans might actually work out, and we'd all die of boredom halfway through. If I were a commencement speaker, I would advise all new graduates to forget about life plans and go to graduate school. This will extend the period during which they don't have to think about a life plan for 5 years or even 10, by which time it will be too late, of course. Better still, I'd advise them to spend a few years travelling to exotic places, learning all the things that are not taught, even on the most advanced graduate curriculum. A certain amount of life planning is necessary, of course. Even the freest of spirits must remember to collect his or her salary check and stock up with cat food on a regular basis. But there's no need to overdo it. Long-term life plans, like stock market projections, are dust blowing in the wind. That wonderful 18th century letter writer, the Reverend Sydney Smith, advised his correspondents that the secret of happiness was, quote, to take short views of life, never further than dinner or tea, unquote. By following this advice, all of us, and especially politicians, might avoid the embarrassment that ensues when grandiose and improbable long-term plans come to nothing. That's my advice to the new graduates. Stay focused on dinner or tea, and you won't go far wrong.
This is East End Inc. We heard David Bouchier reading from Not Quite the Stranger, Essays on Life in France, published in 2015, and a non-memoir, Lucky Man, A Life in Essays, published in 2016. David Bouchier's commentaries on contemporary life are heard on WSHU Public Radio. More information on Mr. Bouchier's work is at davidbouchier.com. East End Inc. is heard on the fourth and occasional fifth Wednesday each month. Programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. Here are some upcoming literary events produced by Canio's Cultural Café at 290 Main Street in Sag Harbor. On Saturday, February the 17th at 5 p.m., an African-American literature read-in, co-sponsored with Sag Harbor's John Germain Library. You could read an excerpt by your favorite African-American writer by calling Canio's at 631-725-4926. On Saturday, February the 24th at 5 p.m., author Adam Nicholson in conversation with nature writer and biologist Carl Safina on Nicholson's new work, The Seabird's Cry, Lives and Loves of the Planet's Great Ocean Voyagers. More events are listed at canyosbooks.com. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Calendrill and Catherine Soka. This is Hazel Kahn.